Morning Show with Greg Berg up next. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to the Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. It's good to be back. On today's program, we delve into the rich, fascinating history of the city of Baghdad. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, I look forward to speaking with Tom Klein from Carthage College. Among other things, we will learn about a very exciting new scholarship that is being offered specifically to Kenoshans. On Wednesday, to help celebrate and support the work of policemen, we will be rebroadcasting an interview from a past Morning Show with the author of a very interesting book about police and their work called Blue Blood. On Thursday, we look forward to the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And on Friday, a look at British history through the eyes of servants. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you that the Morning Show archive is housed on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. We're going to be exploring the rich, fascinating, complex history of one of the world's most important cities, Baghdad. We do so courtesy of the meticulous work of Justin Marozzi, a highly regarded author and journalist who has traveled extensively through the Middle East and throughout the Muslim world, written extensively about it in several books and in contributions to such notable publications as the London Times, the Guardian, Financial Times, and so on. And his most recent book is called Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood, A History in 13 Centuries, in which he does a truly amazing job of bringing the city of Baghdad, and in particular, its complicated history, thrillingly to life. He was recently appointed a senior research fellow in journalism and the popular understanding of history at Buckingham University's Humanities Research Institute. This new book is published by Da Capo Press. And again, it's called Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood. Justin Marozzi, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg. Very good to join you.
Ahead of us talking about this book specifically, I wonder if you could give us some idea of what has drawn you to this part of the world and to the rich topic of the Middle East and its history. Did anything in particular initially pique your interest?
I think as a child, I grew up with the Middle East as a sort of background atmosphere with my father, who used to export veterinary equipment, agricultural machinery, and so on to North Africa and the Middle East. He used to spend a lot of time in countries like Libya and Iraq. And so that was always going on in the background, problems with visas, problems of being paid, suitcases full of blood oranges, and, you know, father disappearing for months on end and then coming back from fairly exotic locations full of presents and stories of the Arabs and life in the Middle East, which I found really compelling from a very early age.
Hmm. And I can see how, given the times that we live in, with this region of the world being so crucial to world affairs probably your interest has only grown and deepened, and the importance of your work only grown in scope as the years proceed.
I suppose one of the sort of the slightly sad things at the moment is that the Middle East, the Arab world, the Muslim world, Islam itself, I suppose, finds itself in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. Only this morning I've just been reading about this German journalist who's returned from 10 days with the Islamic State or the so-called Islamic State fighters in Iraq. And, these are harrowing stories, what's happening in the Middle East to innocent Muslims, Jews, Christians, the minority populations being steadily wiped out. I think these are extraordinarily turbulent times in a part of the world that is no stranger, sadly, to instability and violence.
Speaking of that, in the opening line of your acknowledgments, you mention these words: Baghdad is not the easiest place in the world in which to live, work, or conduct historical research. I mean, probably that's one of the larger understatements that one could make. I wonder if you could just say a word particularly about the matter of living and working and trying to do research in a place like Baghdad. I mean, we can kind of imagine some of the most obvious ways in which that might be a really tricky matter. What are some of the maybe less obvious ways in which it has been quite a challenge for you?
God, crikey, there are so many different challenges on to answer that question. I think I'll begin with probably the most obvious one, which was just the sheer levels of violence. So I arrived in 2004 as the Coalition Provisional Authority tenure of Paul Bremer came to an end midsummer 2004. And, every time you left the compound that was then known as the Green Zone or the International Zone, you really ran a real risk of being blown up, being targeted either by snipers or IEDs, improvised explosive devices. And the simple matter of going across town to meet someone for an interview was fraught with risk, especially for them, actually, more so for the Iraqis than for foreigners like myself, who generally had very high levels of protection. And I spent much of the last decade in Iraq, and I think the research became more and more difficult because, for understandable reasons, most Baghdadis have better things to be doing than talking to a foreign historian. They're trying to keep the families together. They're trying to keep their head below the parapet. A simple trip to the market is potentially dicing with death. So I also found myself drawn increasingly to Iraqis living outside Baghdad. There are plenty of in London. I've got some very good Iraqi friends in the U.S., former ambassadors, diplomats, business people, who tragically, like so many Iraqis, have found themselves forced into exile all over the place.
Hmm. How much of the historical record or various artifacts that would be valuable to a historian like yourself, how much of that kind of tangible legacy has been destroyed by the conflict that has been such a part of life in the Middle East for such a long time? I suppose it's impossible to even quantify something like that in a meaningful way, but can you give us a general sense of how much of the historical record as such has been lost?
Well, for once, actually, the answer to that is less a question of conflict and fighting than the simple fact of what these buildings, the great edifices and the monuments of the Abbasid period, the five centuries from 762 to 1258, almost all of those great buildings were made of sun-baked or kiln-fired mud. And because the River Tigris, which runs right through Baghdad, was prone to flooding for centuries, right up until the 1950s, there have been terrible floods followed by epidemics of plague. And during those floods, some of the greatest buildings of the Middle East were just simply sort of swept away by the waters. So very, very little remains. There are one or two pockets of ancient architecture in Baghdad which are fabulous to visit. The heavily restored Mustansiriya University, which claims to be the oldest in the world, it's the 13th century. a few facades of mosques and religious colleges. But really, you have to go back into the Ottoman period, much later, a little bit less impressive, to see some of the great historical record that you refer to. And unlike Damascus, which many of its buildings were built of stone, Iraq, unfortunately, that wasn't the case. And so it was much, much less remains to this present day.
Baghdad, as I understand it, was essentially created around the year 762, and in some respects, born out of this split between Sunni and Shia Muslims. Say a quick word about that division and to what extent it is important for us to understand and acknowledge that in understanding the history of Baghdad itself.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think even to this day, you'll find Iraqis, I believe, in denial on this question. And I remember having arguments with and debates with all sorts of Iraqis who would either accuse the Americans or the Brits of having invented these sectarian tensions. And at that point, I hadn't studied the history of Baghdad, so I'd listened, you know, to what they had to say. But when you start doing more research, and in particular Baghdad, as you say, founded in 762, and 13 years later, after the death of the Caliph Mansur, the founder of Baghdad, he left specific instructions to his son and heir to take a key to an underground storeroom when the news of his death was confirmed. So after he dies in 775, the son trots down to the room, the underground storage room, thinking it's going to be full of treasures, gold, silver, precious jewels, and so on. And instead, he opens the door and finds a crypt full of dead bodies, men, women, and children of all ages. And the only thing they have in common is that every single one of them is a Shia. So I would argue that the persecution of the Shia goes back, and the sectarian tensions goes right back for 13 centuries at least. And unfortunately for Baghdad, unfortunately for Iraq, these places are at the fulcrum of the sectarian divide. And I don't think one needs to go into massive detail on the sort of theological differences. Essentially, it's a political conflict over who should run the Muslim world. For the Shia, it should be the descendants of Ali and the Prophet Muhammad. And for the Sunni, it should be decided as to who is the most fit to rule by the consensus of the community. And, you know, whether it's the conflict in the Middle Ages in the Middle East or right in the 21st century that we see today raging across the region, the Sunni-Shia tensions are at the heart of it all, and they were not invented by the West.
Hmm. We're speaking with Justin Marozzi, and we're talking about his book, Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood, A History in 13 Centuries. You mentioned that the foundation of Baghdad, like that of many great cities, is enshrined in legend. And you say that so beautifully. And, of course, you're also, in a sense, also highlighting what makes the work of someone like you so difficult, I should think. That is, in trying to peel away layers of legend in order to understand exactly how the city of Baghdad came into being. Can you just say a word about the kind of legend that has sprung up around the foundation of Baghdad?
Yes, I mean, I suppose there are a number of sources going back to shortly after the founding of Baghdad with a series of historians. And there's actually quite a lot written about some fairly important things like the dimensions of the city, the way the outside walls were built, the way Mansur, the founder of Baghdad, took a very keen personal interest, pacing up and down for making sure that the measurements were correct, keeping a very tight rein on the builders, the foremen, fining them, and if he thought they were guilty of any sort of corruption. I think one of the things that interested me particularly was that he was said to have consulted the Christian community of monks who were living in the area, and they sort of pointed him in the right direction and said, this will be a favorable place for you to found your new capital, with details running from, you know, it's no danger of mosquitoes in this particular location, to more sort of geostrategic questions of, you know, trade communications, the river going north and south, the camel caravan trade routes passing through this particular area, and so on. So there's quite a lot of a mass of material to sift through. And it is a much newer city than other places in Mesopotamia, like Mosul, Nineveh, or the ancient city of Babylon, which is only about 50 miles south of Baghdad.
You mentioned that when we read these chronicles, or your word is navigate, when navigating, you say a word of caution is needed when navigating these early chronicles, histories, and geographies. And I think you're talking again about that ancient Sunni-Shia divide, that so much depends upon who has written a given history, a given account. And I suppose even when one such account is an, in a sense, tainted by heavy bias, nevertheless, if you're aware of that, it's probably possible for someone like yourself to really glean an unvarnished truth, or at least a kernel of truth from it.
I suppose, yeah, in a way, you have to sort of triangulate between what are potentially rival histories. You know, a Sunni perspective on, or, you know, a traditional Orthodox Sunni historian is less likely to you know, say kind words about, you know, various Shia communities. And even within the Sunni school of Islam, there are different sects which can be fiercely opposed to each other as well. So always, as you say, it's something to be totally aware of. And I remember many times with my various collaborators on the book frequently being corrected by someone, and I had to say to myself, hang on, is he saying this because he's not at all keen on the Shia? And sometimes the prejudices, you know, are very out there in the open, and you hear a very educated Sunni Iraqi starting to talk to you very pejoratively about peasants, barbarians, kebab sellers, people who are not fit for government, and they're talking about the Shia community. And I think at its most extreme, I remember a very dear Iraqi friend who helped me on this book, and he flatly refuses to this day to admit that the Shia are a majority in Iraq. It's just something he won't entertain for a second, refuses to believe it. Hmm. So there are deep antagonism and shared histories. Frequently, obviously, there's been great coexistence and peaceful times together, but there are these dreadful periods that blow up from time to time when both sides are just at each other's throats and the blood runs on the streets again.
Mm. We've already mentioned the name of the man credited with founding Baghdad in 762, Mansur. He is, do we pronounce it Caliph or Caliph? C-A-L-I-P-H?
In English, we'd say Caliph, yeah.
Caliph. Yeah. Explain exactly what that term means. It's obviously a position of supreme leadership, but in what way should we sort of equate that term with one more familiar to us in the West?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's slightly different, because in the Islamic world, there is no great difference between temporal and spiritual authority. So for Muslims in that period, the caliph is simply the supreme leader of the Muslim world, whether that is Morocco on the northwest in Africa, right the way to Afghanistan and Central Asia in the east, one supreme ruler. I mean, in practice, even though the Abbasids ran their great Islamic empire for 500 years, even within that half millennium, there was a sort of splitting and a dilution of their authority, and the different regimes, different dynasties in places like Egypt and Morocco were taking their own power and their own destinies into their own hands. But nominally, they were subject to the rule of the caliph. And it's interesting that this term has reappeared now in Iraq and Syria, especially when they're talking about the resurrection of the caliphate. I think one of the things I would say to these militants is they need to go back to history school and learn what the caliphate actually was, because I would argue that the caliphate is at its strongest, its most dynamic and progressive when it is at its strongest in a multi-faith sense of the word, with Jews, Christians, and Muslims all coexisting more or less peacefully. What we're seeing now is a terrible introversion and a perversion I think both of Islam and also of this historical idea of the caliphate, which was a much more enlightened place than the sort of barbaric regime that we're seeing taking root today.
You write at one point in the first chapter of the book, from what we are told of him in the histories, the Caliph Mansur shared many of the qualities that came to be associated with the city he founded. Tell us about some of those most distinctive qualities which you believe were shared between Mansur and the city of Baghdad, which he founded.
Yeah, we know that he was a very religious figure who made his prayers assiduously five times daily, was interested in sermons, delivered sermons, listened to religious leaders, surrounded himself with these sorts of eminent figures at his embryonic court in Baghdad. So he's a man of great religious sensibility, and Baghdad is a cornerstone of Islam. One of the reasons why the militants of IS would like to take Baghdad one day is because it still has this great history and heritage as one of the great Islamic capitals. So that takes root from the earliest time of Mansur's rule. So the Islam is front and center stage there. I think there's also a question of cultural refinement. Although he was sort of fairly penny pinching and austere as a leader, Baghdad, from a very early stage, becomes the sort of cultural metropolis of the world, and great scientific achievements, maths, medicine, astronomy. In the 9th and 10th centuries, there are more discoveries made in the Abbasid Empire, headquartered in Baghdad, than in any previous period of history. So there is that sort of cultural interest and the religious interest. And I think also I would probably say that the enduring theme of cruelty and violence. That little story I mentioned a moment ago about the crypt full of dead Shia, men, women, and children, really is the earliest example in Baghdad of the sectarian tensions, which then bedevil Baghdad for the next 13 centuries, right until the 21st century. So I found quite an interesting confluence of interests and themes between the founder of Baghdad and the city itself.
One of the most notable achievements in the actual construction of Baghdad is this concept of the so-called round city, something which you call startlingly innovative for its time. Explain to our listeners what the round city was.
Yes, and this really was a complete innovation architecturally for anywhere in the world. I think it was a very difficult design to pull off from a mathematical and geometrical perspective. It was monumental. The size of the walls were prodigious. It could be seen from miles and miles away. And it was very intricately and carefully built with a series of gates in the outer walls, four gates, north, west, east, and south. In the corresponding direction of the great trade routes, Basra south, Damascus further west, and so on. The markets were in the outer reaches, in the sort of the outer circumference within the walls, and then right in the heart of it, the centerpiece of the city was the great palace of the caliph, and right next to that the mosque of the caliph. So you have the sort of the seat of political power and Islamic power right in the heart of the city. And there was a writer called Jahiz who was mesmerized, really, by this round city. And he wrote at the time, I've never seen a city of greater height, more perfect circularity, more endowed with superior merits, or possessing more spacious gates or more perfect defenses than the city of Al-Mansur. So it was sort of heralded from the earliest days as a great architectural feat and creation. And I suppose the sad thing is today there's absolutely no traces of it left anymore.
Mm. One of the things you mention is that this spectacular mosque occupied the heart of Baghdad for 500 years, but that the date of its final demise is unknown. And that's just sort of staggering to think about, that something so spectacular there for such a long time could have its demise, or at least the point of its demise, shrouded in mystery. It tells us something about how turbulent, tumultuous, chaotic the city's history is, that we don't know something, the answer to as basic a question as that.
Absolutely right. It's a sort of sad reflection, really, as you say, of the, you know, the repeated waves of violence that take their toll on the physical fabric of the city, you know, as much as on the human population. And I think, you know, Baghdad these days is a fairly shattered city. The infrastructure, once again, is coming under terrible pressure. I mean, I remember when I was there 10 years ago, the sewage system was just not functioning at all, and there were the lakes of sewage throughout the city. And, the one constant, I suppose, in the history of Baghdad are these periods of terrible violence that shatter the city and the human population as well.
We're speaking with Justin Morozzi and talking about his book, Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood, A History in 13 Centuries. I wanted to be sure to ask you, at what point did Baghdad come to be known as City of Peace? I mean, an ironic name, to be sure, given what you were just saying about how violence has left such deep pockmarks on its history over the centuries. It appears that from very early on, it came to be called City of Peace. When and why and how did it have that nickname attached to it?
I suppose if we left it to Mansour to answer that, he would say the city's proper name is Medinat al-Mansur, the city of al-Mansur. You know, al-Mansur in Arabic means the victorious. And he named the city when he founded it in his own name. But that name just never really took off. We're not quite sure why. And what did take off was Medinat al-Salam, the city of peace. And that is based on a verse from the Quran, which also has its sort of note of irony, if I read it to you, is God invites you to the house of peace. Those that do good works shall have a good reward. Neither blackness nor misery shall overcast their faces. They are the heirs of paradise, where they shall abide forever. And I suppose the irony there for me is that there's been huge amounts of blackness and misery and all too little in the way of paradise for the city. Despite its name, I mean, you don't generally hear Baghdadis now calling this their city, the capital of Iraq, as the City of Peace. But that was the enduring name that stuck, rather than that which the founder Mansour gave it.
It is in this period, at its founding and shortly thereafter, that it is, in your words, the most prosperous city on earth for several centuries. I'm wondering, first of all, if it's possible to know that, or it must be kind of an interesting challenge to compare whatever great cities might have existed at that point in time and sort of weigh their respective greatness and levels of prosperity. But clearly there was something extraordinarily prosperous about this city of Baghdad. What were its primary sources of prosperity, and just what kind of dimensions of prosperity are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think there are a number of elements to it. I think we've got to take into account immediately the question of royal patronage. Now, once Baghdad became the capital of the Muslim world, and having displaced the Umayyad dynasty of Damascus in Syria, just to the west, Baghdad's almost, you know, inherits the wealth of the Islamic Empire, and you know, this is pretty much a world-spanning empire for its time, right across to the shores of the Atlantic in the west, to the mountains of Central Asia in the east, with a fairly advanced taxation system, which is making, you know, bringing in income revenue from the trade, which was absolutely at the heart of the richness of this empire. And it was said that, you know, a trader could go from one corner of the Islamic world to the other without any fear of being attacked, and his documentation would result in various taxes being levied. And it was a fairly well-developed system. with Baghdad at its heart. And so, like a lot of these, the empires historically, whether it's Rome or Athens, the capital becomes the richest city. And I think the opening decades are really an extraordinary period because it doesn't take long before there's a property boom, and some of the greatest minds are flocking in from all across the Muslim world, whether they're philosophers or poets or dancing girls, concubines, you name it. Baghdad sort of becomes this great magnet for almost tidal waves of migrants coming to seek their fortune in this really rich city. And some of the sums are mentioned, you know, millions of dirhams and dinars for palaces, and people competing with each other to build the biggest palaces. And then they find that they've built something bigger, too big for themselves, and the caliph has an eye on it, so they give it to him in a sort of form of deference. There's conspicuous consumption, there's competitive consumption, and it really just becomes this unbelievable metropolis and the capital of the world, really.
You mentioned that that Mansour not only creates the city of Baghdad, but bequeaths a dynasty that endured for five centuries. And the most notable figure amongst that that dynasty would be, I believe, his grandson. That is Harun al-Rashid. Explain why he is such a notable figure compared to others in this dynasty. What sets him apart?
Yeah, that's interesting. And because we spoke a few moments ago about legend, and actually, if you speak to a lot of Muslim historians, they'll say, of course, Harun is the most famous of the caliphs. But the reason he's the most famous is because of the Arabian Nights, which are a series of often very fanciful, legends and stories and made up tales, you know, very tall stories. But Harun, and I would also argue Baghdad is one of the stars of the Arabian Nights in my mind as well. And there are lots of interesting anecdotes and stories that set the scene, whether it's shopping in the market or a scene inside a harem. But Harun becomes famous through this great book. He's a nocturnal street-prowling caliph, traveling around the city to check on his inhabitants, find out what they think about how they're being governed. He's always up for a scrape. He's up for an adventure. He's always running after pretty girls. And he travels with a man called Masrur, who's his executioner. And, the legend was always that such that if Harun, is impressed by someone or someone has done something that he thinks is worthy of reward, he'll chuck him a leather pouch full of golden dinars or silver dirhams. But conversely, if someone has offended him in any way or he feels he's behaved unjustly, the man is forced to kneel in front of him, stretch out his neck, and have his head cut off. So you never know where you stand with Harun al-Rashid, and I think he becomes incredibly famous really through the Arabian Nights. I think in his own right he's a fascinating figure as well, because his rule at the end of the 8th century coincides with this great golden age for Baghdad, when it becomes a great intellectual center for poets, scientists, mathematicians. Lots of music played at court. I think our friends in the Middle East today should be reminded of that. Plenty of wine also being drunk. The ruby red wine of Shiraz pops up again and again in the chronicles. So there are great scenes in the Arabian Nights and also in some of the other sources about Harun and his friends sitting around drinking wine and debating the great issues of the day, talking about history, philosophy, religion, law, and so on, and even cookery writers. So it's a great golden age for Baghdad, both in a real historical sense and then in the more fun, sort of popular Arabian Nights version as well.
You say at one point, I think it's you that makes the point, or maybe you're quoting someone else, now I don't remember, but that Harun al-Rashid could be in some respects compared to Henry VIII. What are the most striking points of comparison there, in your opinion?
I suppose I would probably say what is the question of scale between them as well, because, you know, as a Brit, we have our kings and queens that we learn from school days onwards. I'm sad to say I've rather forgotten the different reigns of our monarchs over here. But he was sort of master of his age, but on a much smaller scale. I'm talking about the English king. Harun is, I mean, not only master of Baghdad in Iraq, but of an entire empire. He's one of the most powerful men in the world. I wouldn't quite go that far with Henry. So it's a question of scale. No shortage of opulence, of royal drama, of extravagance, whether it's sartorial or economic. But Harun is a sort of, you know, is a more impressive figure, I would argue, just because of the sheer scale of his power, his strength, his majesty.
You mentioned at one point that Harun was nicknamed Commander of the Unfaithful, which on the surface sounds a little odd, and it's even more odd when you understand traditionally what a caliph might be referred to. What is behind that nickname, Commander of the Unfaithful?
Yes. This was a sort of rather snippy, chippy, defensive, hostile nickname. It's a reversal of the typical Commander of the Faithful, which is the traditional moniker for the caliph. It's in Arabic, it's Amir al-Mu'minin, Commander of the Faithful. And this is a title which is also used in modern times. You might remember the Taliban leader several years ago pulled out a black cloak, which supposedly was that of the Prophet Muhammad, and he declared himself Amir al-Mu'minin, the Commander of the Faithful. Now, for Harun al-Rashid to be called Commander of the Unfaithful was a pretty cheeky thing, and I suppose that at that time that could easily have resulted in someone having their head cut off. But it was based on the fact that they were, for some people's tastes, far too freewheeling discussions on Islam, on Islamic jurisprudence, and there were also scurrilous stories at the same time of Harun and the dancing girls and the drinking of wine. So, from a number of points of view, this upset the sort of what we might call today the religious hardliners. There was far too much questioning of religion, far too much alcohol being drunk, and far too much interest in pretty dancing girls for the conservative clerics.
Hmm. You mentioned that, of course, Harun al-Rashid is so famous to the rest of the world because of the Arabian Nights. Or 1,001 Nights, as it's sometimes known. You say at one point that this is not a trustworthy historical document, but on the other hand, I think you say something to the effect that it paints a compelling picture of medieval Baghdad. Just say a word about just how much we can learn from this work of fiction. I mean, to what extent is it of true value beyond entertainment value?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it is an incredibly entertaining book, as anyone who's read The 1001 Nights will certainly attest. I like it as well because I think it gives an entertaining sense of the relations between men and women. Women are frequently portrayed as strong and independent figures in their own right, often outwitting their male colleagues, rivals, and adversaries. It gives you a sense of what was available in the markets at the time. So when a woman or a man goes down to the market preparing for an impressive banquet, you hear about the different fowls, all the fruit and vegetables. There are some sort of recipes that give us an idea of what sort of things were being eaten in the palaces of the cities. I think also what I liked about it is that in its sort of taste for the scurrilous and the scandalous, it gives a sense of how much more open the Muslim world was at this time, you know, especially when you compare it to the really dreary, limited ideologues that are holding sway in some parts of the region nowadays. It was a much more open sort of intellectual environment. Things were questioned more. There was less of a taboo on drinking alcohol, even though that's prohibited by Islam. It was observed more in the breach than the observance. There's plenty of texture and atmosphere in the book. So although you have to be careful about how historically accurate everything is, I think it's pretty good in conveying a sense of daily life, of the extravagance in the royal courts, and in the sort of the fun and the texture of everyday life.
Things turned in a decisively different, astonishing direction in January of 1803. What occurred in Baghdad in January of 803 that was so shocking to its population?
Now, if I've got the date correctly, this is the beginning of the civil war between Amin and Mamun. The rival caliphs, brothers and rivals for the throne, Harun had left specific instructions for the succession, but it was never going to work. You know, one son then handing over to his own brother. So what was predicted by a number of the chroniclers, which was fratricide or civil strife, civil war between the two brothers, unfortunately blew out as the worst predictions had forecast. And Baghdad, it's founded in 762. This is 803. So 40 odd years later, the city is destroying itself as the brothers take each other on. And there are bombardments. The mosque we referred to earlier on is under direct bombardment. Much of the city is damaged. It sort of sets the scene for 13 more centuries of disputes in political power, an inability to have smooth and peaceful transitions from one ruler to the next. Hmm. And in this case, from the very highest levels of the Abbasid royal family.
There's also this period in which the capital of the empire is moved away from Baghdad to a newly built city called Samarra. How significant is this in terms of the history of Baghdad itself? I mean, what happened to Baghdad in the wake of this dramatic move?
Yeah, Baghdad, it's a bit of a snub, really, for this new imperial capital. For a number of decades, it's less than a century, but it's most of one century, I recall, the capital moves north. And this is also a reflection of the fact that there's a military class emerging, and the caliph himself is becoming more of a puppet figure. Whose lineage and royal blood is respected, but the political power starts to ebb away, and he becomes the sort of puppet of this new military aristocracy. And a new capital is created north of Baghdad on the Tigris, as you say, called Samarra. Baghdad slips out of the chronicles for several decades, understandably, until I think it's 892. The power is returned to the city, and the dynasty then is headquartered in Baghdad and Baghdad only until 1258. So it's back center stage again after this sort of slightly embarrassing hiatus when it's effectively stripped of royal political power.
Mm. We should mention that your book goes into great detail that we have no time to explore today, unfortunately, but into great detail about the scientific breakthroughs, the great poetry that is written there, the place of music in society. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about some of the lavish, spectacular entertainment that was a hallmark of Baghdad in this period, in terms of public spectacle and even pigeon racing. I mean, you really explore some fascinating things here. Just give us a little sense of what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think one of the great spectacles for Baghdadis, and it benefited from royal patronage from the very top, was horse racing. And there were a number of hippodromes built by successive caliphs over the years. And there are these lovely accounts of the caliph being seen in his royal pavilion, taking a great personal interest in the horse racing and people running around. We suspect that there were people betting on horses, although that would have probably been done slightly discreetly because that also was prohibited by Islam, gambling. But it's also interesting because in the context of Arab culture and history, this great interest in horses and in breeding, and you know these days we still have the Arabian as a great horse of stamina and speed. There were all sorts of public displays. Pigeon racing, you mentioned earlier, was hugely popular. That was much more of a sort of lower class sport. And occasionally it was used for nefarious purposes as well, with thieves pretending that they were trying to retrieve a lost pigeon, clambering across the roofs of Baghdad, actually using it as a way of breaking into someone else's house. So there are plenty of social activities, big crowds. I think executions also drew their own crowds. In the sort of more sinister displays, there were criminals who had been executed, were strung up on the bridges of Baghdad, the pontoon bridges, and left to rot in gibbets as warnings to the population that if you crossed the caliph or if you disputed his authority, you are likely to end up dead.
Mm-hmm. Well, the history, of course, is chronicled from there in your book in rich detail, including those moments when Baghdad comes under the control of outside invaders for the first time in 945, and is the subject of other calamities as well, including, as you've already mentioned, several catastrophic floods. And your book takes us all the way to the present day, and offers a surprisingly positive view of the resiliency of the population of Baghdad, who historically have endured so much and for whom life continues to be very difficult. I wonder, in the last minute or two that remains, if I could return to an interesting place in the book where you talk about Rashid Street, named, of course, after that most famous of all leaders of Baghdad, Harun al-Rashid. You, in a sense, take us down Rashid Street in modern-day Baghdad. Just tell our listeners about that. It's an interesting moment in the book in which past and present come together.
Yeah, it's interesting, Rashid Street, because for most of its history, Baghdad is a city of narrow, winding, labyrinthine alleys. And it was built like that for a reason, so that external invaders would quickly get lost. They wouldn't know their way around, and the city would be able to defend itself with the defensive population. Rashid Street is built in around the First World War to enable troops to go from one side of the city to another, and it is just built in an absolutely straight line right across the city, and anything or anyone in its way is just bulldozed and crushed, unless you had quite a lot of money and you could just about persuade some of the builders to move it one way or another. But it becomes the great street of Baghdad, full of restaurants, coffee houses. There are ancient mosques on either side of it and religious colleges. And it becomes the sort of lifeblood of the city. And people of a certain age remember it in the 1950s, and they all go all sort of misty-eyed, and they talk about the cinemas and the coachmen who used to drive up and the courtesans plying their trade along the street. It was where Saddam Hussein, as a very, very young man, tried to assassinate the president. All sorts of adventures and episodes in the history of Baghdad from the 20th century have happened in and around this great sort of street. It's a little bit like Oxford Street in London or something like that. Architecturally very impressive as well, with these Mashribiya balconies that stick out of the first floor of the buildings, enabling people to look down onto the street below and see what's happening without being seen themselves. It's rather tatty today, and obviously it's dangerous just to wander around the street these days, but it is still regarded with great affection by Baghdadis today as one of the great streets in the city.
Mm. The book again is Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood, A History in 13 Centuries, complete with maps and diagrams and extensive photographs, further enriching this meticulously researched book by Justin Morozzi, published by Da Capo Press. Justin Morozzi, I thank you so much and congratulate you on writing such an impressive and interesting book. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Carthage College's Tom Klein. On Wednesday, the author of one of the best recent books about police and police work, Blue Blood. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential.